You're listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KZYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs, and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both places. My guest on this program is Michelle Bullis-Walker, Senior Lecturer in Philosophy at the University of Queensland, Australia. Dr. Walker's research interests span the fields of European philosophy, aesthetics, ethics, and feminist philosophy. Her teaching interests in philosophy include intersections with politics, film, and literature. Her most recent book is Slow Philosophy, Reading Against the Institution, in which she argues that philosophy involves the patient work of thought. In this, it resembles the work of art, which invites and implores us to take our time and to engage with the world. At its best, philosophy teaches us to read slowly. In fact, philosophy is the art of reading slowly, and this inevitably clashes with many of our current institutional practices and demands. Professor Walker, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So, as I was reading the book, I thought that the challenge of this interview will be to bring the orientation that you advocate in the book to bear here in this interview, both for me and for my radio listeners. So, while your end focus is on reading, you draw a lot upon an idea or, I guess, an image of listening. And so, in that vein, I wanted to start with a quote from later on in the book, if that's okay. And that is...
Sure.
So the quote is that listening provides us with an attentive attitude towards the other, one that essentially slows us down. This involves a letting be that places us in no hurry to determine or impose meaning on the other's speech or on what the other has to say. We pause in front of the other with an almost infinite patience, listening for the present of speech. We suspend our usual inclination to make a judgment and decide what the other has said. With this, we simultaneously suspend our immediate decision either to agree or disagree with what we imagine the other has said. Attentive listening is slow because it draws out the process of reading, helping us to register the habitual ways in which we rush to a judgment without waiting patiently for the other's speech to fully emerge. The patience of attentive listening involves an open exchange where listening is not mediated by shared understanding, but by difference. Attentive listening respects the other's difference. And while I think that quote does a great job of saying what listening is for you, I certainly think it's worth talking more about and expanding upon that. And then I'd appreciate you beginning to connect this idea of listening and attentive listening to your larger project in the book. I hope that gives you enough to get started with.
That's quite a lot. It's great that you've focused initially on the question of listening, because even though that's only one chapter of the book, to me, it's an important part of the book and perhaps the hub of it in certain respects. It's a long passage that you've cited there. So in response, I guess I'll go to the sense that counterintuitively, listening is, in the way that I'm exploring it, listening is not necessarily the sense of a shared understanding. In fact, listening in this sense suggests something other than shared understanding, and that otherness is difference. And I think this is difficult for us at a common sense level sometimes to grasp, because we assume that listening involves parties who do share understanding. But I think what slow reading, what I'm trying to get at with slow reading and this attentive notion of listening is that what we need to be open to is strangeness, what we don't understand and what we can't or shouldn't reduce back to ourselves. Is that the kind of thing you were after?
Yeah, exactly. And actually, listening has been something that I've been interested in for some time. And I've actually often thought of reading as listening, as a kind of listening, a deep listening, and paying really as close attention as I could to what the person was saying. And as you say, as I reflected in that quote, not prejudging it, part of not prejudging it is not being aware of my own judgments, my own assumptions, and really doing my best to listen to what the person who is writing or speaking, because I think it translates both to reading and listening to people in a more face-to-face or in a phone conversation.
Yes, I mean, it's a good place to start for when we are having a conversation, like you said, a great distance, and listening's what we have to engage in to get anywhere. I think what's interesting there is that listening is all about attention, as you mentioned there. It's all about attention, and it's so much about dropping any kind of preconceived frame that we might bring to our engagement with the other. And like you, for me, it seemed intuitively that reading is this intense mode of listening, or at its best, reading becomes this very intense mode of listening. And there's so much, I think, that we can gain. As I mentioned in the book, the history of Western philosophy is really dominated with perception in terms of sight and what's visual. By bringing the question of the auditory and listening to bear, it's an attempt to, in some senses, challenge that aspect of Western discourse.
Let's head into that a little bit, because it seems to me that one of the themes of the book is this distinction between an institutional academic approach to philosophy. And I'm not sure that most of my listeners would be as familiar with that as I might be, because I'm in one of those institutions. So could you start to frame that argument of your book, this distinction between a kind of institutional philosophy as an academic practice, and what you term an instituting philosophy, and maybe where it all began?
Okay, well, that's helpful. I'll just come back to the title of my book, even though the subtitle is, in fact, Reading Against the Institution, when read carefully through the book, what I'm really trying to do is actually read in such a way that we reinvigorate and rethink the institution. So just to bring that to the fore. But where this all starts is in many senses going back to our Socratic heritage. And that is that the idea that philosophy starts out as a way of life, that doing philosophy is very much a practical expertise. Someone like Pierre Hadot later on talks about this in terms of the history of, or the beginning of Western philosophy as a series of spiritual exercises aimed at making us better people, making us good people and better people. Now, in many senses, we can think of this as the guiding principle of philosophy in the West, or the guiding idea of philosophy in the West. And it's tied very much in terms of Socrates' way of thinking with this notion of philosophia, the love of wisdom, philos and sophia, the love of wisdom. So the idea is that philosophy starts as a seeking toward wisdom, as a love of wisdom, and that the institution of philosophy, the instituting of philosophy, is dominated by this openness and this way of perfecting our lives, this philosophy as a way of life. Now, over time, anything that starts, anything that's instituted, tends to become instituted, or anything that's instituting, sorry, becomes something that's instituted. So the play that I work on there, again, is a kind of an insight that comes from some of Adil's work, and that is that whilst we start out with philosophy as a way of life, philosophy over time becomes a kind of sedimented institution with rules and laws and regulations, and that in doing this, it actually, in effect, philosophy loses its way. Now, if we bring that into the contemporary context, what we're looking at is the fact that on the one hand, we've got this guiding idea or this guiding principle, this search for wisdom, this search to make ourselves better people, and this idea of philosophy as a way of life, but it comes up against the structures that get set up, the academic structures historically through scholasticism and then into the contemporary world, where philosophy becomes this institution that at times, in fact, makes it very difficult to pursue philosophy as a way of life or as this transformative experience. It becomes more a scholastic, academic process. Now, in the contemporary world, the danger is that institution becomes even more so a corporation, and that something that's set up as a kind of way of life, philosophy as a way of life, as a transformative experience, becomes a corporatized experience that makes it very difficult to pursue this. So the relation, just to bring that together, the relation is not just simply oppositional. It's not that philosophy starts out as a pursuit of wisdom or the love of wisdom and becomes a kind of corporation or an institution. It's that the love of wisdom remains within the institutional context throughout, right up until today, but that instituting or that guiding principle, in a sense, becomes lost lost, not gone, but in a sense subterranean. So what I'm trying to do in my book by talking about slow philosophy and specifically slow reading in philosophy is to re-engage that instituting moment that motivates philosophy in the web.
So a question arises for me and arose for me when I was reading the book is, does this for you relate to a sense that I get from my students often that philosophy is very abstract and disconnected from real life, and the things that philosophers seem to concern themselves about don't really make any difference to people's everyday concern?
Absolutely. And of course, you know, I encountered these issues myself and certainly with my students. And I think it's our students that keep us absolutely alive and awake to these issues. So for me, teaching is a really important aspect of the whole process of philosophizing. So yes, the abstraction, the generalization, the conceptualization that's occurred is helpful and useful in times. But if it's all that we do, then we're losing a great deal. Because for me, I go back to that sense of the guiding idea or the instituting moment of philosophy as being about self-transformation.
I want to follow up on that some more, too, and the connection between self-transformation and the idea of wisdom, because another thing that I find in teaching and in life generally is there, I don't want to say exactly that there's no respect for wisdom. There might be, but there's very, it seems to me, very little acknowledgement of wisdom and what wisdom might be. So perhaps you could elucidate that a little bit more. And then this idea of transformation, because it seems to me to be connected. And for the most part, I don't find among my colleagues or an expectation among my students that a class is going to be transformational for them.
It's interesting too. Now, in terms of wisdom, in terms of defining wisdom, that's an incredibly difficult thing to do, and it's not something I guess that I would set out to do. But I think what I can suggest here is that on the one hand, I've countered wisdom with a very, very limited notion of knowledge. So in the corporate context, what we provide more often than not to the exclusion of wisdom is knowledge. So that gives us some idea about what wisdom might entail. Wisdom is certainly more than fact, and it's certainly more than a very limited notion of knowledge. Now, I'm not saying knowledge in general, but what I want to suggest with wisdom is a transformative process that opens us out to where we started really with this discussion, Stuart, and that's the sense of an attentive waiting on the other, whether that's through listening or reading or thinking or whatever, an attentive waiting in terms of the other or the world, an attentive waiting that allows us to engage what's strange to us rather than to close ourselves down to what's strange to us. So in some senses, what I'd be suggesting here is that wisdom is the kind of wisdom of an openness to the world and an openness to others in general, an openness to what is strange.
Yeah, that makes some sense. When you're talking about this kind of corporate approach to knowledge, it seems to me that that ties into another thing I notice in life and in my students is that kind of information has become king, that if you get the information, that's sufficient for knowledge, and the issue of wisdom doesn't even kind of enter the picture. But it certainly seems to me that information alone isn't sufficient to count as knowledge, though our educational system seems to be very much set up in that direction.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And in that sense, obviously, there are similarities across our cultural differences. In the West in general, I think you're quite right that information has become king. I talk a lot about the desire to know, a specific form of the desire to know in the book. And I counter that to wisdom. But that desire to know is very much about a calculative process that gains information. And in our modern technological world, information is most certainly king in that sense. So what we aim to provide in philosophy is a counter to that, even though more often than not our students will begin by expecting that. And that's where we come back to the question of wisdom. And another way of thinking about this question of wisdom is, of course, to come back to what I mentioned at the beginning, the very term philosophia, the love of wisdom, is also, if we turn that round, what we have is wisdom is also the wisdom of love. So what I mean by that is the transformational process of philosophy is a kind of loving opening out to what's out there rather than a reduction of what's out there to information that we can easily grasp.
Right. And I want to get into that, too. And a big way that you get into this and expand on this is through examining the thought of a number of different philosophers. And I do want to head in that direction as well. But I think it would be useful, since you're talking about slowing down, if we get into that. And one of the things I think you do effectively in the book is try to show that there are some negative connotations to slow. But maybe you could talk about that, and then talk about that in relation to what seems to be a pretty much a cultural norm, is this idea of fast pace and I don't have enough time and everything is hurry, and try to draw that distinction out a little bit more.
Okay, well, slowness, you know, yes, as you mentioned, I talk in my book about all of the negative connotations that we've come in the West, particularly in our post-industrial West, we've come to associate with slowness. And what I've tried to do is offer a very modern reframing of the term slowness, which of course resonates with certain political movements and practices in throughout the Western world today now, whether it's the slow food movement or slow cities movement or various other things. Importantly, we're coming to appreciate the fact that this strange equation of speed with efficiency is, or speed with some kind of moral goodness, or speed with you know, the being an ultimate value in its own right, is somehow part of our modernity that we often don't question. Now, whilst I do in certain senses think of slowness up against speed, what I'm more interested in doing is talking about the senses in which haste is problematic. So fast and slow are not necessarily the terms I would really want to put in opposition, because things can be fast. We can carry out our philosophy at times. We can read at times fast, in a faster way, but still in terms of the slowness that I'm recommending. So it's haste, and it's a kind of reductive, what I've referred to in the book as an instrumental and institutional kind of reading that I'm against. The kind of reading that fails to engage again with what's particular and unusual in a text, philosophical text or whatever. So, yeah, I start in a sense with problems with speed in our contemporary cultural context. And that takes me to the question of slowness. Why slowness? Well, effectively, I think it comes down to the fact that slowness provides us with the opportunity for an attentive relation to the world. So what ties together all of the forms and metaphors of slowness that I explore in the book is this quality of attention that slowness allows us to gain. And again, the motivation for thinking of slowness is that by sitting with something over long periods of time, this gives us a chance, again, to experience a deep and radical kind of transformation, whether it's of our ideas or our prejudices or our being.
So let me bring what I find, and one of the things I try to do, I just started a new introduction to philosophy class today, and I've actually modified a little bit how I introduce this to my students because of reading your book. But I have been taking this kind of approach to some degree. So when talking to them about reading the assignments that I give them, I let them know that there'll be a fair amount of reading and that the reading will often be challenging to them. But I advise them that I'm really not interested in having them read it just so they can come back into class and say that their eyes gazed upon the pages, that they need to take it more slowly. If they can only read a paragraph and then stop and think about it, reflect on it, see how it might relate to their lives, that to me is more interesting and more beneficial to them. Now, this certainly goes against the grain of the institutional model where we assign the reading and they're supposed to get it all done.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Absolutely. And of course, this differs from class to class. Sometimes we have enormous first year courses with, you know, hundreds of students, and other times we're privileged to have small third year or honors groups with maybe, you know, five or six students. And obviously, the way we approach these different situations will mean that we can approach the question of reading differently. But I so fully agree so much of what we do institutionally is about range and coverage, and where so much of what orients or motivates universities and institutions is anxiety, the anxiety to cover as much philosophical ground as possible. And when we do this, we're setting ourselves up for a real danger, I think, as you're implying there. The ability to sit for a semester or a term with, you know, a certain number of passages that we really keep coming back to and contemplating and recontemplating, this is an incredible luxury. And yet, this is what philosophy has been for so long. So what we're facing here are the expectations of the more corporate structure of the institution, the university these days, and the desire to actually engage in this philosophical work in ways that are going to transform us, teacher and pupil alike.
So in those larger situations, I don't have classes of 100, but I do have classes of 35, and so I recognize the difficulty there. Do you have some idea of what an institutional approach that takes this slow philosophical reading to heart, what that would look like? Would we get rid of those 100-person introductory classes or continue to do them? Can you talk a little bit about what your vision for the impact might be and what it would look like?
Well, it's difficult, of course, and it's something that's always in my mind because this whole project, the book of Slow Philosophy, came out of my teaching experience in a very positive sense. It came out of my experience. This is a kind of a roundabout way of responding to your good question there. It came out of my experience of, in certain contexts, say with the first year course, reading certain texts many times over many years. For example, you know, fabulous texts like Plato's Symposium or Plato's Phaedrus. So reading the dialogues and going back to them year after year and just discovering that in that process of not necessarily each time reading them slowly, but in the process of returning and rereading those works over many years, so much comes out. So in terms of, you know, me, the teacher in that context, there are ways that the institution, even though the institution makes this difficult, there are ways that we can still gain this sense of slowness that I'm talking about. In the context of the student's experience, I think we are still blessed to have the institution of the tutorial. So we have the very large lectures, which, for example, this semester has entailed around 300 first-year students. But then we have the small, intimate space of the tutorial, and that's where the work of learners can be carried out and affected and experienced by the students. And this makes a huge difference to what the experience of the course is overall. Now, in conjunction with that, I also think of this slowness over the whole career of the student, so that from the first year experience through to the end of the degree, or even into the honor, what we call here the honors year, or into graduate study, that the slowness is something that I aim to provide the, you know, that they will encounter throughout that entirety of their philosophical apprenticeship.
So it seems to me, too, that since we're probably not on the radio here talking to a lot of philosophy students, that we can expand this idea of slow philosophy, slow reading, a slower approach to life to beyond just the institution and beyond just the study of philosophy. I assume you've thought of that, and maybe you could expand on that a little bit and see how it might be this approach that you're talking to about, an open, listening, slower approach, really is a way of life. Philosophy is a way of life, but this open approach to life as a way of life that can be more broadly generalized.
Yes, indeed. I think it's in the preface to the book. I say at one point that whilst this is very specifically an engagement with the values and the advantages of slowness in philosophy and an attempt to bring back what I see as the starting point of philosophy, to reintegrate that into the very contemporary experience of the university, it is much more generally applicable to any of us who read. So the question of whether we read professionally, institutionally, or whether we read absolutely for pleasure, or whether we read in other kinds of work context, the question of reading here is one that I would like to couple with the question of slowness. So there I think we have, you know, we bring in a whole different huge section or sections of the community that are not involved in the kind of philosophy that we're engaged in. But beyond that too, I do think that this notion of a kind of attentive almost meditational relation with the reading that I've developed or talk about here. This is most certainly something that bears import outside of the domain of both philosophy and reading more generally. And in many senses, I guess you could say that to some extent, modern practices of mindfulness perhaps link up with some of the ideas that are coming out of my work. And in that sense, that may help others who don't work philosophically to think more in a more generalized way about what I'm suggesting.
It also leads to me to a section in your book where you talk about and try to distinguish between kind of traditional or old habits of reading and this new approach to reading that you're talking about. Because I think it could certainly applies to philosophy, but it could apply to reading a novel or reading something else. And probably one of the typical habits of reading these days when it's done is more for entertainment or pulling out the information. So maybe you could expand on it in that direction just a bit?
Most certainly. Throughout the work in this book, what I do is I preface each chapter with a few lines from a particular book, a particular novel that's been important to me, Richard Flanagan's Gould's Book of Fish. And the reason I do that, well, there are many reasons I do that, but by the end, in the conclusion, I come and talk about the way that novels like Flanagan's have sustained me throughout the long process of thinking through and writing the work, and that it's the pleasure and it's the deep, deep immersion that we can regain from our so-called non-professional reading or our pleasurable reading, our recreational reading, if you like, how important that can be. And what I'm suggesting is that, in fact, what I've done is that my absolute love of immersing myself deeply in the world of the novel, that's my recreational world. I bring that recreational world back to my professional world as philosopher, and I learn lessons from that and argue that that's the same kind of engagement that we need to give to the philosophical text. Now, all too often, what we effectively are asking students to do when we give them a reading exercise is to come back and list three main points. And whilst that there can be some sense in that and some use, the utility of that process is often hides over or covers over the sense in which there's something, there are many things in that work that they've deeply missed in their attempt to sum up the three points or the three arguments that are made in any given work. There's enormous detail that's missed. So the idea here is that if we are the kind of recreational readers that do immerse ourselves deeply in the work, emotionally, physically, intellectually, in all those senses that we explore the atmosphere of the work, then let's think about what that might look like when we come back to the philosophical text. And let's think also about our response to reading in different ways. So what I mean by that is that, for example, often when we set a piece of work for a student in terms of a reading exercise, often what will be expected in response is a refusal or a refutation of the argument set out. And again, to go immediately to a kind of adversarial or oppositional mode of reading is perhaps to miss what's particular and germane to that particular text. So the idea here is that we try and set up reading as something that engages and engages deeply rather than as an exercise that attempts to demonstrate the wrong of what we've given the student to read.
It brings me back to this idea of engaging in the reading, open listening, in a way that aims towards some kind of transformation. Or another way I might put it is to emerge from the reading a slightly different person, to allow the reading to alter one's point of view, to challenge one's assumptions, to really, as best one can, get into maybe the mind or the point of view of another person. Maybe you could start to explore that a little bit with some of the different authors that you talk about. Michelle Leduc, is that how it's pronounced? Maybe she would be a place to start.
Yeah, Michelle Leduc's work is fabulous, and that is, I engage her work right at the beginning in the first chapter. She has an interesting idea of work reading that I think is just very helpful. It seems simple, but it's actually it's more complex, and it's very helpful, I think. She thinks of reading as work, and a kind of particular work that opens out our experience of the text. And in a sense, what she's perhaps arguing for is the sense in which the work of our reading is not just some kind of faithful repetition of an argument that's being made or a case that's being made, but that the work of reading becomes a kind of co-contribution or a co-creativity where we engage, you know, in a very profound way with what's in the work, but not in any sense that sets the work up as an authority. So it becomes more an opening out to what's happening in this particular text or a sense of engaging with this and then a building upon this. So I guess, I find her work very helpful in that sense.
I'd like to expand on another person. These are people that, frankly, I had not been exposed to, and I have to assume that perhaps some of them are what would count as feminist philosophers. Is that correct?
Yes, some of them are, and they are philosophers. Certainly, some of their work has very feminist orientation, and their work, these philosophers are philosophers that I've been familiar with for a long period of time, and it had never occurred to me to think earlier of their work in terms of reading. But when I came to this project, I was astounded that probably because of the very political orientation of their philosophical work, there was so much there to think of in terms of a kind of transformational process of philosophy as transformative, and that transformative process was very often than not connected with reading, even though the question of reading is not necessarily always consciously addressed by these particular philosophers. In one chapter, I look at the work of the German philosopher, the critical theorist Theodor Adorno, and that's, again, his work's something that's accompanied me for decades. Really, his work is probably where I start philosophically. And it was a very small essay of his, literally called On the Form of the Essay, that really got me thinking about reading in the kind of way that I've explored it in this book. And what Adorno has to say, what Adorno says in so many different places, is what he's engaging with is how philosophy is done and how philosophy might be done differently. And in this context, he's saying, well, you know, in terms of writing philosophy, a form that we overlook, a form that we often deride, is the essay. And yet, really, philosophy should engage with the form of the essay. As a way of thinking and as a way of writing, it provides us with the ability to kind of meander in our thought, to follow a line, not to have to, in a sense, systematize and logically structure necessarily a specific argument, but to follow an idea, to explore an idea. Now, for some, that's going to be a fairly challenging way of thinking about philosophy. But for others, I think it's revelatory and it's liberatory as well, in that sense of that philosophy doesn't have to be reduced back to a very systematic, very purely systematic and purely conceptual mode of working. So the whole discussion that Adorno provides on the essay in this essay, I turn that around and say, well, that's a fabulous way of thinking about reading as well. So I develop this notion of an essayistic reading, which again doesn't have to be reduced wholly to some kind of systematic or totalized notion of reading where we are completely certain that we've gained every fact and every bit of information that's possible in a reading, but a kind of reading that actually meanders through themes that emerge in any given philosophical text. So that's just a starting point for thinking about another way that a particular philosopher that I'm interested in has inspired me to think differently about reading.
So I hadn't encountered this idea of the essay, but so I'd like to just make sure that I'm understanding it clearly. And so you're talking about an essay as, I assume, something like shorter than a book. And in a book, particularly in philosophy, and I do interview a fair number of philosophers about their books, and it seems to me that their books are really fundamentally arguments where they try to cover all the bases, answer as many of the objections as they can, put together a whole theory beginning to end and have it be kind of whole and complete and self-contained. And the essay you're talking about, I assume, would be something shorter and, as you say, meandering and kind of more exploratory, right?
Yes, in that sense. And for that reason, not subject to an external principle. So the thought that occurs within the essay is not subject to a particular utilitarian end or a particular end point. What's interesting is if we go backwards to where we were a moment ago with the philosophy of Michel Le Durf, the French philosopher, many of her books we could think of really as collections of essays. Of course, there are thematic links necessarily in these essays, but she herself would refer to some of this work in terms of, these are essays that, you know, that I've explored. So the idea of the essay in this context is the ability to actually experiment both in style and in and content. It's kind of exploratory. It's, as I said, it offers a kind of, you know, there can be fragmentary and partial explanations rather than absolutely complete ones. The ephemeral, you know, the fragmentary and the ephemeral idea can be touched upon. So, yeah, I think the essay here is interesting. Now, what's interesting is that, of course, in terms of book production, and that's a huge part of the work that's considered important in the modern institution for philosophers, in terms of the of book production, there is a tendency to do precisely what you were referring to, and that is to provide as much as possible a kind of watertight argument that is carried out throughout the book. And whilst there can be fabulous work that comes from this mode of writing and thinking, it's not the only mode of writing and thinking that we should condone, and that the essay, I think, has its place, whether it's a collection of essays in a book or whether it is literally the essay.
So would you now tie that to this idea of essayistic reading? How does that translate to an approach to reading, whether it's an essay or a novel or a philosophical text?
Well, again, rather than trying to assume that my reading, whatever text I pick up, whether it's a text by Heidegger or whether it's a text by Kant or whether it's a chapter by Kant even, that my reading is necessarily going to be a complete exegesis, a complete explanation of the text, a definition, and then perhaps an argument against the argument provided in the text. Whilst that's completely valid and important philosophical work, an essayistic reading might approach the work by thinking in terms of the atmosphere that Kant establishes in this chapter or in this book that we're reading. So we might engage with the kind of intensities or the atmosphere that are produced, different ways of thinking about what it is in the text that captures our attention. So an essayistic reading is going to be more open to the subtleties and perhaps even, you know, to use a psychoanalytic term perhaps, even the unconscious of the text, the what's in a sense repressed in the text, what can't be said by the argument that's provided.
So that leads me exactly to the point that I wanted you to take up next. And again, I'm not sure how to pronounce this woman's name. Is it Luce Irigaray? Is that right?
Yes, Luce Irigaray.
Oh.
Yeah.
Irigaray. Okay. And because she, it seems from your book, she does take into this more kind of psychological work and the idea of the unconscious. And you mentioned in that chapter in the book about paying attention to some of the repressions and denials and some of the background in somebody's reading. And I wanted to ask you both to expand on her work and if you could give an example maybe of a reading of that type where you might have seen something deeper in the text through looking at it that way.
Irigaray's work is really interesting and really challenging, and like Adorno's work and like Leduc's work, the reason I guess I engage with her work is that she provides me with particular ways of doing philosophy that offer alternatives to what we might think of as particular institutional philosophy or mainstream philosophies in the West. Again, this is not to suggest that the kind of philosophical work that Irigaray provides is the answer to philosophy, but it's one of many alternatives, and for that reason I find it really valuable. So it's not an either or case, but it's important to draw attention to these kind of philosophical works that do challenge our presuppositions about what philosophy is and how it should look. So in Irigaray's case, what's interesting is that she's very much deeply connected into the history of Western philosophy, and much of her work is a clear engagement with that. But her early practice also involves having worked psychoanalytically as a psychoanalyst. So she's very much au fait with the practices of analysis. And I think what's interesting is that she brings this awareness, this therapeutic awareness in a sense, the psychoanalytic awareness, to the way that she actually looks at philosophy, does philosophy, and reads philosophy. Now, a simple way of trying to make sense of that is perhaps by saying that what happens in psychoanalysis is first and foremost the process of speaking and listening. So what the analysand does is speak, and what the analyst does is to listen. And Irigaray takes that position of the analyst, who's trained in a very deep and careful mode of listening, and she brings that to the history of Western philosophy. So when she reads texts, whether they're by Plato or Aristotle or Spinoza or whoever it's going to be from, she listens to what's being said in both the sense of what is being said and perhaps what can't be said. So bringing a very psychoanalytic sensibility to bear, she listens to the repressed or listens for the repressed of those texts. Now, in her case, much of what's repressed in the history of Western philosophy, much of what she reads when she reads the history of Western philosophy, is the inability to engage with the question of sexual difference. And that's what makes her work very much a kind of feminist philosophical perspective. But the question of what we can hear when we read a text, when we're reading in this particular mode for what might be not said or repressed in the text, this can be any number of things. But I find her work helpful for that starting point. Now, in terms of the way I use her work in my book, or the way I engage her work in my book, I've looked specifically in one chapter at two images that she raises. One's love and one is wonder. And I've looked at the way those terms come to define particular modes. Well, I relate them to particular modes of reading. So, for example, in the case of wonder, this comes out of the reading that Irigaray does of Descartes' Passions of the Soul, a fabulous book of Descartes, and also a very fabulous reading on her part. And what she does there is to demonstrate that Descartes provides us with this incredible insight about another mode of philosophy, one that's not about analysis and argument, but one that's about the passion of wonder and the role that wonder plays in the philosophical process. And her description and her engagement with Descartes then provides me with a way of thinking about wonder then as a mode of reading philosophically. Similarly, in her reading of a section of Plato's Symposium in Diotima's speech, she raises the question of love in a way that equates the philosophical process with love. And again, I use that as a way of thinking through metaphors of our relation to reading. So love and wonder are helpful in those contexts, but in quite different ways. And then in a further chapter, as you've mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, I look at what Irigaray has to say in much later work of hers in terms of the role of listening in philosophy. And that's where, again, while she doesn't use this to talk about the question of reading, I think about that concept of listening and the attentive mode of listening, and I bring that back as a kind of model of engaged philosophical reading.
I have to say that the chapter on Descartes was fascinating, because he certainly isn't normally presented in Western analytic philosophy in the way that you discuss in that chapter with wonder. He's really kind of the father of the separation of mind and body, and a very analytic kind of approach, and very much trying to do an argument, and obviously an epistemology seeking certainty. And so that was it was very interesting to read that about Descartes.
Well, that is really interesting, because, of course, Descartes is also the author of not just The Passions of the Soul, which is his last work from memory, but A Discourse on Method. And in my book, as you will have seen too, Stuart, A Discourse on Method provides us with four principles that guide a kind of modern scientific approach to philosophy, that ground a kind of modern approach. And when we think of the Descartes of the four principles, and then read Passions of the Soul, it's an incredible experience. Now, in The Passions of the Soul, Descartes does raise this fabulous idea of wonder, but he ultimately does subsume it under a kind of more, let us loosely term it, analytic mode of doing philosophy. But there are just these moments in that work that provide us with a very, very different view of what kind of philosopher Descartes was.
So it's not exactly in your book, and I think there is a connection, but maybe we can explore this idea of that you raised with Irigaray and love as an approach to reading, and making that connection. And if you feel inclined to, maybe connect that to women and philosophy and their take on philosophy and their additions to philosophy. Western philosophy has primarily been a patriarchal system, and And so it seems to me that that's a part of this too, and there's a theme in some of this thinking that you're providing.
Oh, thank you for that opportunity. There are several chapters in the book where the theme of love comes back, but in each place in different ways. But it does start with this discussion of the love of wisdom right at the beginning of the book. This is what grounds the investigation. Now, again, to come back to the term philosophy, philosophia, love of wisdom, we can think of the love of wisdom as grounding the process or as grounding the practice of philosophy in the West. But it's not just a love of wisdom, but we can turn that round to being too, as Uruguay says, a wisdom of love. So it's both things. It's both the love of wisdom and the wisdom of love. Now, what that's suggesting is that from Plato on, at the very least, philosophy necessarily engages the question of love. Love is not external to the philosophical practice. Love is not something that we may think of as an interesting theme that philosophy can engage with. No, love is fundamental to the process of philosophy. And what does this mean? Well, I think it has meant different things at different times, but in terms of the way that I've been interested in exploring it in the book, is to look at the sense in which love provides the model of an openness, or ideally it provides the model of an openness to the other, or in this case to the text that we read, rather than a kind of a foregone conclusion. We open to the text in various ways. So I look at that in terms of the particular discussions that Uruguay provides. I continue that in the chapter on the philosophy of Simone de Beauvoir, because Beauvoir offers us in The Second Sex, in her groundbreaking work, The Second Sex, she provides us a very interesting distinction between, on the one hand, a kind of romantic love, and on the other hand, an authentic love. And I explore the way she separates and distinguishes between those terms, and suggests that we can think of those two terms as providing us different ways of approaching reading. So, for example, a romantic reading, on the one hand, is a kind of immature approach to the text, whereby we assume that the text is all-knowing and that our relation to the text is, in a sense, to give ourselves over fully to it. An authentic relation, on the other hand, or an authentic love, that when Beauvoir defines it, is something whereby we encounter the other, or in this case, the text, though that's obviously not Beauvoir's point, we encounter the other as subject and subject. And so we acknowledge the possibilities and the strengths of the text, but we also acknowledge its limitations and its frailties, if you like. So put simply, the idea here is that authentic love provides us a kind of more mature love, or a more mature approach to the way that we do our philosophy, whereas romantic love provides us with a kind of an immaturity. Now, again, it would be easy to oppose these two terms and see them as a either-or situation, but I'm more interested to demonstrate how an initial kind of romantic attachment to a philosopher or a philosopher's text, and I think as philosophers we all know what this feels like, that initial romantic approach where the philosopher can do no wrong, or that the text can say no wrong, this can lead over time to the maturity of a much more nuanced account, a much more nuanced reading. So I don't think it's that we have romantic love or romantic reading in this context and then authentic reading or authentic love in another context, but perhaps over time, in the right context, that the kind of romantic impulse can become an authentic, mature impulse. So that's another way that love surfaces in the book. And then in the chapter on the work of another French writer and philosopher, Hélène Cixous, I look at her idea of the approach and the way that intimacy and love provides us a kind of preparation for the state that will allow us to read in more open and nuanced ways, in my terms, in more ethical ways. So that's another way of looking at that, at this question of the way that love opens us out, which is all to say, to bring it back again to the sense in which when we look at what Socrates is talking about in dialogues such as the Symposium or the Phaedrus, he's talking about the importance of a passionate, erotic encounter that grounds what will become our eventual philosophical relation. So to me, it seems completely relevant to use love and passion, if you like, as philosophical modes of discussion and in this context, reading.
I have to say, in reading these parts of the book, it reminded me of some of the work of Martin Buber, and Maurice Friedman wrote a book called Confirmation of Otherness, which is really about this sense of being open to and relating to somebody. And in Friedman's work, and I think in Buber's work as well, there is this idea of doing it through a text, different kinds of texts perhaps, but I don't know if you're familiar with either of those and if you would have any comment about any connection there.
No, vaguely, of course, with Buber's work, but not the other, and I'd be really interested to follow that through because it sounds fabulous.
So just if there's one more thing we can do, and we're getting down to the end of the time, I'd like you to expand just a little bit on this idea of ethics and how you bring ethics in, and I think it does connect to this idea of having a real, authentic relationship with another, and in particular in this book, through relating to their text. And that is an ethical relationship because it's a relationship that's open, right, and respectful. And anything else you'd like to say about that, to just expand on this idea of an ethical reading of these texts?
It's important because ethics is, of course, the guiding principle that's underlying so much of what I'm saying in the book or hoping for. And I guess what I've implicitly done is to equate the ethical relation with the transformative relation. So the ethical relation is the one in which we're open to change and to reconsideration and whatever may come our way. So ethics in that sense for me very much involves a kind of exposure to the other, or to the other text in this context, the other ideas, if you like. It involves proximity and sincerity. They're two terms that that I borrow from from Emmanuel Levinas's work. To me, yes, this exposure allows this sense of opening up to, again, the strangeness either of the world or the text or the other person or the idea, without closing down and deciding in advance that we understand it, we get it, we've reduced it back to what we already know. So ethics is the encounter that extends us beyond any knowledge that we may possibly have now. I think that's the way I would like to think of ethics. And the reason I've linked it with slowness is because, to me, it takes time, in a sense, to set up and experience these ethical encounters that expose us to strangeness and ultimately to difference. So slowness allows us the willingness to wait, to pause, to listen, and probably to hesitate, rather than coming very quickly to a conclusion about what's happening. And that links in with what we were talking about earlier, Stuart, of the attentive listening. Attentive listening provides us that ground for reconsideration of what we've actually experienced. So in that sense, I think it's transformative. I think this is what I relate to this notion of kind of maturity and a kind of mature encounter. Is this kind of ethical encounter that does provide the possibility of transformation. In many senses, I guess what I'm really saying here is that ethics is the experience or experiences of allowing us to counter what we could call the ego subject, or the sense of our own self-importance and self-centrality. So ethics is what undoes that tendency that we all, of course, have to always placing ourselves at the center of everything. Ethics is the process of opening that up. And when I explore that by the end of the book, by the conclusion, I start to talk about ethics in terms of grace, which is a term that we don't often necessarily find in philosophical discussions, though there are, of course, fabulous philosophers who do engage with questions of grace. Simone Weil and others, of course, come straight to mind. So in this sense, ethics for me is this, the grace of, in a sense, deflating the ego self in a way that makes it possible not to lose that ego self, but to quieten that ego self to listen to the other.
And I have to say that it's that kind of transformative process that really is on the path, at least, to wisdom.
Yes. It's like wisdom is not something, you know, attained in that sense, but it is, it's that discerning process of opening to the other by means of quietening the self.
Seems like that might be a pretty good note to end on, unless there's anything else you'd like to say further.
No, it's been an absolute delight. Thank you, Stuart.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.